Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast for today, August 19th, 2019. I am Noah Rothman, the associate editor of Commentary Magazine. With me is senior editor Abe Greenwald.
Hi, Noah.
And on the road, in an undisclosed location, Christine Rosen.
Hi, Noah.
John Podhoretz is out today. Commentary Magazine is the 70-year-old monthly of intellectual opinion, erudition, and general perspectives on philosophy that you must be reading. A all-access subscription is $29.90-something. What? How much is
$29.95.
It? $29.95. Digital subscription, $19.95. We just had the September issue come out, and it's really fantastic. One of the articles is actually going a little viral on its own, an article by Abraham Sorcher, reviewing the episode that happened at Oberlin College when there was an effort to intimidate a local bakery, I suppose it was, and the politics behind it and the behind-the-scenes stuff. It is a really fascinating article. It's doing very well, and it merits it. You should go check it out. Also in that issue, a lead article by Naomi Schaefer Riley about the trouble in which feminism today finds itself. Our own Christine Rosen with a review of The Good Fight. Not especially favorable review, right, Christine?
That's right.
I'm putting words in your mouth.
It's
if I
mean.
Want to.
It's mean.
It's mean. It's some mean stuff. I have a review of the book American Carnage, which is, I think, pretty interesting. You might like it. It's generally a very good issue, so go check it out. But we're not just going to be talking about our issue all day. We're also going to be talking about some of the news of the day, including a wild controversy that erupted late last week when congresswomen and BDS supporters themselves, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, sought to try to gain access to Israel and were denied on the grounds of this law that prohibits BDS supporters from entering the country to propagandize against Israel's existence. But it occurred on the heels of a Trump tweet resulting in an outcry from all circles, even Israel supporters in the United States, suggesting that Israel had been bending to the will of a president and rendering this relationship between the United States and Israel partisan, and therefore endangering it in the event that a Republican doesn't have the White House forever. It seems a pretty prudent objection to Israel's policies. But in the interim, we begin to look a little bit more critically upon the efforts, the group that was sponsoring Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, and also their intentions, and whether or not Israel had a point that was that didn't really matter whether Donald Trump was involved at all. The president was irrelevant, in fact.
I think that there were people actually all along, for supporters of Israel, some who were fine with this seemingly last minute decision to bar Omar and Tlaib from entering the country. Don't forget, this happened after months ago, in advance of this trip, there was Israel had said that they would, in fact, let them in, and now had said they wouldn't. There were some people who support this, who had supported this decision from the start. I'm not entirely with them. While I do think it was generally a mistake for Israel not to let them in, I think that contrary to what the president tweeted, a strong democracy can show strength by sort of letting people like that kind of roll off and not making too big a deal out of them. At the same time, I don't think it's anywhere near the debacle that some people are making it out to be. I think there are some good arguments and there are some bad arguments, and I think, for example, the idea that that either Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar might have been had their minds changed or influenced by being exposed to the real beauty and wonder and majesty of Israel, that was never going to happen. I think the idea that Israel ultimately takes a PR hit here is true, but I think that also has to be weighed against the potential for the PR hit that they would have taken had Tlaib and Omar gone around on this propaganda tour with this anti-Semitic group that organized it, MIFTA. We should get into that a little bit. It's a group that promotes blood libel charges against Jews, promotes neo-Nazi literature, celebrates bluntly terrorism against Jews and so on. But all that said, yes, I think there would have been a certain benefit in Israel's just kind of stoically going with the flow here.
So from I'm sorry, Christine, briefly.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to restate the objection from a domestic policy perspective, from the point of an American which supports Israel, but also is leery of the relationship between Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump, which has come to typify American-Israeli relations. The objection here that I saw that I find compelling is that Donald Trump doesn't care about BDS. I don't think. I don't really think that he has any. His interest is in Israeli sovereignty here. His interest was in highlighting two people who he finds to be a sound foil for him politically. These two members of the four-member squad, and isolating them and having exerting the power of the presidency now to make them a foil for him politically, which is in keeping with some of the stuff that he does as far as using the powers of the presidency to execute vengeance, notably at the top of my head, this episode where he denied Nancy Pelosi the use of a military plane to visit Afghanistan just because he was having a fight with Nancy Pelosi at the moment. It is nothing less than an abuse of power, and one that could be in the long run detrimental for supporters of Israel who want to see the relationship remain a bipartisan one.
Yeah, I think that is an important point. I don't know that he doesn't care at all about BDS, but certainly his main objective here was to play that partisan game with the so-called squad and whatnot. I just want to say also, it's going to take a lot of work to steer the Democratic Party back from the cliff towards which it's been heading on Israel, and I don't know that this at the end of the day is going to be decisive either way.
I agree that, I mean, personally, I think they should have just let them in, because if there's anything we know about these two members of the squad in particular, it's that they often open their mouths and say something stupid or, you know, hateful or awful, and they get themselves into trouble all the time. And I think we did see that a bit with Tlaib when she claimed, oh, they're refusing to let me see my beautiful grandma. I remember she posted a picture of her grandmother on Twitter and, you know, oh, grandma. And so the Israelis said, okay, well, we'll let you go see your grandma. And then she's like, actually, I don't want to do that because you know, that's not fair. So I mean, the fact, this is a woman who will use her grandmother as a prop in her campaign against Israel. So I think that, you know, any idea that this is an ethical tour rather than a propaganda tour was revealed by that. I will say, though, that one of the things that really shocked me was the way that this nonprofit group that sponsored their tour, MIFTA, the way it's being treated by the mainstream press, right? It's basically being given a cover by the mainstream press, which calls it, you know, a humanitarian group or pro-Palestinian group. If a Republican was sponsored by a like-mindedly extremist organization to go on any sort of foreign trip, we would be hearing about it constantly. So I do think that there's a real lack of due diligence on the part of the media that's covering this whole debacle in not really questioning who is this group, what do they represent, what are their values. I'm not seeing a lot on that. You see it in the conservative press, but you don't see it in the mainstream press.
Yeah, and going forward, we're not going to see Omar Tlaib's feet held to the fire on this. You know, right. Being questioned about what kind of organization did they think this was? Do they still stand by it? What do they make of these charges? It will, outside of the precincts of conservative media, that issue will die.
What do we make of all that? I mean, it's advocacy on the part of the press, obviously. It's subtle advocacy by omission. But what is the objective? Just that it clouds the notion that Donald Trump, I mean, because we have some synergy between this organization and white nationalist groups, does it, and this sort of dovetails with the second topic of the day, but does it just cloud the really clear narrative that the purveyor and beneficiary of white nationalist sentiment in this country is Donald Trump and only Donald Trump?
There's that, and there's a concerted effort right now in mainstream media to turn the delegitimization of Israel into some sort of upstanding activity, and revealing the types of organizations and people who are actually behind those ideas messes up that argument.
Christine, you agree?
I think that I mean, we have seen this with we see this with any time there's a story written about hate crimes. If the hate crime's committed by what's considered by the mainstream media to be a beleaguered minority, then the story's not going to get as much play, right? And I do think that there's – but what's striking to me is that if you want to make your beat, white nationalism, white supremacy, all the stuff that the mainstream media folks claim to be deeply concerned about because of Donald Trump, then you're only going to undermine that case by being so partisan in how you cover it. And that this isn't true of all journalists, obviously. There are some who still try to be consistent. But I find this striking, because if you agree that white nationalism and white supremacy are harmful forces, then you should root them out wherever you find them, not just when it's, you know, conveniently someone with an R next to their name, not a D.
Yeah, I mean, this, at the risk of moving on into our second topic a little prematurely, I mean, this seems to be an increasingly prohibitive focus of the objective press, quote unquote, the center left press, and the explicitly liberal press, and all of them sort of melding together into the Democratic Party's political ethos, that racism is the singular focus of our attention today, and that is exclusively limited to one side of the political aisle, and that side is benefiting from these sentiments, which have a lot more purchase than anybody thought. We're going to get into that in a little bit, but I did want to read something that leaked out of this New York Times town hall. Did everybody get a chance to take a look at that? So apparently, yes, there was this town hall was being held between among New York Times staffers, reporters, editors, you know, member of the company, and the transcript was published on Slate, and some excerpts have been making the rounds, and I wanted to read one line from an unnamed staffer who was probing Dean Baquette. I'm not sure what his title is. What is his title? Managing editor? He's
something like that.
One of the head editors over at the Times. Yeah. So I have a question about racism, the quote begins. I'm wondering to what extent you think that the fact of racism and white supremacy being sort of the foundation of this country should play into our reporting. Just because it feels to me like it should be a starting point, you know? Like these conversations about what is racist, what isn't racist. I just feel like racism isn't everything. It should be considered in our science reporting, in our culture reporting, in our national reporting. And so to me, it's less about the individual instances of racism and sort of how we are thinking about racism and white supremacy as the foundation of all the systems in the country. And then it leads on to the vaunted New York Times Magazine project, which we're going to talk about briefly in the coming minutes, the 1619 project, which is about the origins of human slavery in this country. But Baquette's response wasn't especially, you know, enlightening or heartening, rather, because he sort of accepted the premise and then went on to jawbone as sort of, I think it was just a way to get out of the question, but he didn't challenge the premise really at all. And this is what we've been talking about in this podcast for months now, is the extent to which the youngish cohort of media professionals are dedicated to the idea that the nation is irredeemable on its foundational ideas, not just the presence of racism and human slavery at the dawn of the country, but also its capitalist ethos, its general support for sort of a neo-colonial project as far as power projection goes. Just virtually every aspect of the state of the nation today is irredeemable to this cohort of cultural revolutionaries on the youngish left, who are increasingly to the left of the people who are already very much ensconced on the left, who are in charge of these institutions. They are simply not radical enough for the youngest people coming up behind them.
And in their large vocal numbers, they have the ability to instill fear in their older, less left colleagues and make them hew to their radical line.
I mean, they've demonstrated the extent to which they can execute policy preferences and punish dissenters pretty effectively now for the last 2-3 years. So briefly, before we get into that, I'd like to turn your attention to the wonderful folks at Blinds.com. For many of us, your blinds or whatever you have on your windows is an afterthought. But with brand new, made-to-order custom window coverings from Blinds.com, you can really transform the look and feel of your entire home. When they're right, everything in your home looks better, but when they're wrong, everything in your home looks cheap. So when I need to go to buy new blinds, there's only one place I will go, and that is Blinds.com. With 15 million windows covered and over 30,000 five-star customer reviews, Blinds.com is America's number one retailer for affordable, quality, custom new window coverings. Whether you're looking for energy efficiency, or maybe you just moved, or you want to refresh the look of your home, Blinds.com makes the whole experience fast and easy. Blinds.com makes just send them pictures of your house, and they send back custom recommendations from a professional who will work with your color scheme, furniture, and specific rooms. They'll even send you free samples to make sure everything looks as good in person as it does online, and every order gets free shipping. And this is the best part. If you accidentally measure or pick the wrong color, if you make a mistake, Blinds.com will remake your blinds for free. They've really made it easy for you, so there's no excuse to leave up those mangled old blinds. And for a limited time, our listeners get $20 off at Blinds.com when you use promo code COMMENTARY. That's Blinds.com, promo code COMMENTARY for $20 off. Faux-wood blinds, cellular shades, roller shades, and more. Blinds.com, promo code COMMENTARY. Rules and restrictions apply. So we touched briefly on the 1619 Project, which has overtaken the internet. It is, which, by the way, has nothing to do with regular life and what actual people are talking about, but it does trickle down because these are the people who dictate the terms of the conversation, and eventually they will force you to talk about this. So this is the project is a noble one. It's essentially a symposium of essays examining the history and legacy of American slavery at its 400-year mark, that insofar as you could date it back to an origin point. They have it at 1619, and there's a series of essays. I haven't gotten through all of them. I've read a couple. Some of them are valuable. Some of them are interesting. Some of them are less so, a little bit more conjectural and, frankly, revisionist. But generally, I like the mission of the project, with the exception of some of the voice that is applied to it by the New York Times editors. So there's individual essays written by individual authors, but the voice of the paper comes through in the introductory paragraphs of this thing, and even in the titles and headlines. And I think the tone is set for this piece really early on. I mean, not just in the headlines that we're talking about, but the tone and the editorial direction of where they want to go with this thing and what they actually want to achieve. Give me a second while I pull it up. But this is it's a interesting look into what the Times is trying to do here. In the days and weeks to come, the editorial introducing the symposium essays begins. We will publish essays demonstrating that nearly everything that has made America exceptional grew out of slavery. That's a broad, sweeping statement, and clearly one intended to execute a political task to shift the conversation towards the direction of where the youngish progressive cultural revolutionary is, which is this country is irredeemable and racist and bigoted and doesn't deserve the kind of praise that it receives.
So I just want to make a small point, then Christine, I'll let you jump in. That's why I can't say that I think this is a noble undertaking from its start. From your initial description, something that would simply sort of look back at the impact and legacy of slavery, sure, that is a noble project.
Well, essays do that. At least the ones that I read that I liked.
But by its very inception and its own declaration, this is intended to do something different from that. And I can't.
No, I think that. But in some ways, it's incredibly savvy to have that editorial framing. No, Americans love to read about their history. You know, we actually do like history. Want to learn about it? And a lot of the initial responses I saw to the project were people saying just that, saying, wow, you know, here's some stuff that we might not have learned enough about in school, and I'm kind of curious. And some, I've only read a handful of them so far, I intend to finish reading them up this week. But what disturbed me from the perspective of someone who's trained as a historian was the sweeping claim, the lack of distinction between saying that slavery has profoundly impacted American culture, American life, American political system, and saying that it is the sort of the foundation on which the country is built, that it, that everything good is tainted by slavery. So that those are two different things. And I think the historian's mind wants to say, with curiosity and with empathy, let's try to understand how this happened, when it happened, why it happened, and its repercussions. That's not what this project is trying to do. This is a much more ideologically motivated project. Now, that doesn't mean it's not useful, but I just think that anyone who approaches it thinking they're going to read, you know, a kind of deeply scholarly take on some of this stuff is going to come away surprised. The other thing I think is worth mentioning is that these debates are ongoing among scholars. There's a wonderful new book I just started by Sean Wilentz called No Property in Man. And it basically looks at this from the perspective of the Constitutional Convention and asks this deeply important question. Was our founding document based on slavery? And I think that the sort of 1619 Project approach would say it's all tainted because, you know, you had this bad deal between Southern slaveholders and Northern sellouts, and so it's all tainted. He gives this much more nuanced and fascinating depiction of the various factions in play, you know, and notes some facts. For example, the fact that, you know, many states were already on their way to eliminating slavery or headed in that direction when the convention met. So that there's so much nuance and detail that's required to really think about the legacy of slavery in this country. And that is a project we should do, and certainly one that too many extreme conservatives think is, you know, useless. Like, oh, we fought a war over that, it's over. No, that's really not the case. Right. But I don't know. I have to finish reading all of the essays, but I'm not sure that this is project's approach is going to help add nuance to a really fascinating debate.
Yeah, you know, when we were talking about this right before we started the show, it occurred to me that scholarship generally is marked by, among other things, some disagreement and different arguments about how and why things happened. And that keeps the various arguments sharper and more honest because they have to sort of fend off challenges from those with other arguments. This is, I think, ultimately not scholarship, in part because it is just a mono argument. There's just one sort of take here, and then it's a bunch of evidence and storytelling lumped on top of that.
So right. I was just going to say that they say that. They say the project is going to reframe American history. Right. That's not what we need to be doing.
So I'm going to defend the essays that I read a little bit because I don't think they really reflect the editorial view that the paper has taken. Like Christine, did you read the Nicole Hannah Jones
piece? Yes. Yeah.
So I didn't get the Times framing from her item. I mean, I thought it was nuanced and vivid and sort of takes the good with the bad and the good that grew out of the bad. So I thought it was a valuable addition. There's another essay that had to do with how the origins of American capitalism were in fact racist, and that the white antebellum South was the typical key example of what a capitalist society looks like, which is just ahistorical. I don't think there are very many scholars of this period who would say that the antebellum South was a capitalist enterprise. In fact, it was very much rejected. The kind of capitalist energy that was being executed in the North because it was an attack on their way of life and what have you. You know, we can get into that. It was just, there was obviously an agenda being executed there. But I didn't see that the paper's editorial being reflected even in the headline of the Nicole Hannah Jones piece. That, what was the headline there? It was, our democracy's founding ideals were false when they were written. Black America fought to make them true. That kind of hostility is not reflected in her essay, and it's also nonsense.
Right.
I mean, it's just
right.
Definitionally false. You can't, the notion that there is an ideal can be false just doesn't make any sense based on the word itself. An ideal is aspirational. They're not true or false. They are compelling or not compelling, or a means by which, an ethos around which you can organize a society or not. That's not true. It defies the dictionary definition of true or false. But it gets at what the Times wanted to convey, which is that America's founding is illegitimate.
Well, it's also unnecessarily polarizing in the sense that, for example, it overlooks the abolitionist movement, for example, which had people who were white and black in it. I mean, this idea that we have to racially polarize our history in order to come to terms with it. I mean, it struck me there's this sort of parallel debate going on about white privilege that, you know, we've also talked about that on the podcast a bit. But the rise in the discussion of white privilege, what is it? Is this something we need to change? How do we do that? That struck me as being a more informing editorial force on this, even though, as I agree with you, Noah, that some of the individual essays are just trying to write an essay and sort of ponder. And the best essays take a question and look at it from many different angles, and they don't always come to a simple conclusion. They're supposed to provoke. And I think some of them do in this case, and others don't. I will say, however, the other thing I disagree with is this idea that nobody's being taught about the history of slavery. I mean, I've mentioned before, my kids are, you know, K through middle school DC public school students, and they've had a ton of, you know, historical fiction about slavery. They've had a lot of history. Their entire unit, as they start eighth grade, is going to be about civil rights and you know, the sort of history of slavery. That's great. I mean, they're learning all this interesting stuff. But the idea that the New York Times has to swoop in and rescue us from this terrible education system that pretends slavery didn't exist—it's a little bit navel gazing of the New York Times.
Yeah, I mean, the notion that we don't talk about racism in this country is weird. It's just about all we talk about.
Yeah, but that has been the argument for a long time, that Americans are scared to talk about this, or the original sin of our creation. And it's really never been true as far back as I can remember. I mean, it's always been in the ether at all times.
Yeah,
well, the question isn't just are we scared to talk about it, but the secondary question after that is, once we start talking about it, is there something practical, policy minded, you know, financially restorative that we have to do as a result of that? And I think that's why if people say they're uncomfortable, it's not that they're uncomfortable acknowledging the country's horrible past and slavery as an integral part of that, but it's a question of, well, then what do we do now? Like, is there something we have to do now? What is that? You know, what happens next?
It's also become a litmus test, the extent to which you'll defer to narratives.
Totally, yeah.
Like, you can't, for example, we were talking about this before we started, there is an idea abroad that you cannot discuss the 1619 Project unless you have consumed every essay in its entirety and ruminated on them for a certain period of time, meditated before coming to the consensus conclusion that they want you to come to. That only at that point can you be taken seriously as an observer of race in America. So in that sense, we're iconoclasts here, just spouting off about only two essays that we've read from this entire symposium. But at the same time, providing an interesting perspective, I think, in part because the Times has really tapped into an ethos here, or a bubbling sentiment among the Democratic candidates who are reflective of their voters. So you have to say that they know, they have their finger on the pulse of what the Democratic primary electorate wants. And you've heard a lot of them defer to the themes that we're hearing in the New York Times editorial board's view of what this symposium means, which is that America's racial founding is tainted, and therefore it pervades every institution in American life, and a lot of those institutions are therefore suspect. Probably the case in point is Beto O'Rourke, who is rebooting his campaign for the second time, failing to generate traction among Democratic voters. Basing his campaign relaunch on the notion that America is irredeemably racist. He quoting him speaking somewhere, he's in Arkansas, where he says, our country was founded on racism and is still racist today. In Arkansas, I said what I believe, that there is no denying this reality, and that is why it's incumbent on all of us to change it. So he's not saying anything he really hasn't said before. He's just saying it now to a bunch of different audiences, and also saying that he's not going to focus on Iowa and New Hampshire. So he's not really running for president. He's just launching this tour about how the United States is terminally plagued by really delegitimizing racism.
Well, yeah, I mean, if the problem is that fundamental and massive, then obviously there is nothing else to talk about. There's no other task worth putting oneself towards other than, getting to the bottom of that. So,
and he said this is what he's been saying for quite some time, before the relaunch, he said this country was founded on white supremacy. During the last Democratic debate, he said that the legacy of slavery and segregation, Jim Crow and suppression is alive and well in every aspect of the economy and the country today, which is a very broad, generalized statement, one that I don't think you can necessarily support unless this is a religious conviction, one that doesn't demand support, really. It is an exercise of faith.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know for Beto himself, I think he's probably a little more cynical than that, but I think for a great number of people, it is absolutely an article of faith.
Well, now that we know that Stacey Abrams has, like, you know, made it known that she's ready and available to be someone's running mate, maybe she and Beto can, you know, fight out for the VP slot from someone, because it's clearly the kind of pandering that he's doing at this point is, I mean, it makes me feel sort of sad for him.
Nobody seems to remember that she herself waved off the notion that she would be anybody's VP because it was demeaning. Mm-hmm. Like, it was an insult to her to be considered a caliber of somebody who could run for the presidency, having never held elected office higher than a state house representative.
Right.
That it wasn't a compliment, it was an insult. And the people around, you know, in the commentary community and the opinion and pundit community were also like, oh, these white guys like Joe Biden just trying to use her as a human shield. And now all of a sudden she's amenable, and I guess everybody's okay with it.
I also, just to piggyback on one more thing about the 1619 Project and why I find it, the editorial ethos, somewhat annoying, is that we all know as conservatives, it's been a long time, certainly since the Republican Party has had any significant support from the African-American community at the polls, right? I mean, who's the last president to get even, Eisenhower? I mean, this is the conservative movement has long had this problem. And I think that what these sorts of things make it easy for conservatives to do if they don't want to be thoughtful about race is say, oh, well, look, it's just crazy. And I think one of the things that's incumbent upon those of us who are looking ahead at the demographic trends and looking at the aging of the sort of older white male Republican Party and are concerned for conservative ideas is to say, you know what, we do need to grapple with this. But it has to be done in a way that understands that history is not a tool to be manipulated to get, you know, people freaked out and running to the polls.
No,
it should be something, yeah.
No, there is no limiting principle that's applied when the activist left talks about this. And for everybody who thinks Joe Biden is the big savior, I mean, there are plenty of warning signs, canaries in the coal mine, that he's just as amenable to this narrative as everybody else. Before he launched his campaign, he said something very disturbing. Quote, in the 1900s, so many women were dying at the hands of their husbands because they were chattel, just like cattle or sheep, that the court of common law decided they had to do something about the extent of these deaths. And then he said something about a myth about the rule of thumb, the extent to which that was based on how and the means by which you could use to beat women. And he said, quote, this is English jurisprudential culture, a white man's culture, and it's got to change. That should send chills down your spine, precisely because jurisprudential culture is the foundation upon which all American rights and civil liberties are based. Mm-hmm. This is the sort of stuff that is redeemable, that is valuable, that is the stuff that we sort of sifted out from the baggage that we inherited in the antebellum country and forged the nation that we know today, and all the rights that stem from things like the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment. And this has become a threat to the social justice left. These jurisprudential rights, the sort of stuff that you see meted out in a courtroom, where it has become an obstacle to achieving the kind of collective justice that is envisioned by people who rewrote the rules, the Title IX rules, sent them out to colleges and universities after the 2011 Dear Colleague letter, which prescribed new means by which you could adjudicate claims of sexual assault on campus, and the result was these extrajudicial star chambers in which accused and accuser alike had their Fifth, Sixth, and First Amendment rights abridged. Now, unless we're saying the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights aren't all that great in the first place because this is English jurisprudential nonsense, then I guess we have a point. But we also, if we're going to be intellectually honest with ourselves about the founding of the country and the ethos and the ideals that formed its basis, then those are the things, the Bill of Rights is sort of valuable, even though it came from the same people who were conflicted on race and culture.
Yeah, part of the horror, here, and this goes back to the lack of argument within the discussion here, is that if someone makes a point, Noah, like you just made about our jurisprudential legacy, that gets twisted and spun pretty quickly and pretty viciously as somehow being a white supremacist argument.
But why wouldn't you welcome that if that was your objective? If your philosophy, your political philosophy is such that we define sexual assault too narrowly in our founding documents and our understanding of law, so that confronting your accuser in a courtroom is too traumatic, that mm-hmm. evidentiary standards for conviction of a violent crime are too high, mm-hmm. and therefore we need to undermine these institutions and these ideals. Why wouldn't you welcome calling them all illegitimate and all racist? Because your objective is to tear the whole thing down.
Right. No, nope. That's they do welcome it.
Okay, so this is the indictment. We've established it.
There's a similar challenge when talking about capitalism, right? I mean, there's the same trap that gets fallen into where the left, and particularly the extreme left, says, you know, unless you want, you know, to increase welfare payments and make the social safety net basically, you know, to catch everyone, which of course has its costs, if you worry about how to pay for that, if you worry about, you know, promoting values that conservatives tend to want to promote, then you're mean, right? You hate the poor. And this narrative has a lot attraction, I think, because conservatives, especially today with these younger voters who think socialism is nifty, we haven't been able to persuade them that this isn't about disliking people who don't have money. It's about understanding how capitalism works, understanding and acknowledging as conservatives that there are excesses that need to be curbed or tamed. Figuring out what those are and how to do it is you know, that's what policymakers are supposed to be doing. But that we need to be able to tell a story that's optimistic and positive and says, and again, this will speak to race as well. I mean, you think about free enterprise and free markets. Those help everyone if they function properly. If racism is preventing people from being able to establish their own business or to get a mortgage in a redlined area, that's wrong, and that has to be fixed. And those are the kinds of things that I hear too few conservatives saying, and particularly Republican politicians. So again, I think that there are parts of this argument that conservatives and Republicans are ceding entirely to the other side, and that's a big mistake.
Right. I think, you know, there are these sort of two ways to approach that stuff on the right, and one is the negative. I'm tired of paying for other people. I'm tired of I'm having to pull my weight, and other people are piggybacking off me, and that kind of thing. Or I don't want to have to pay taxes to support XYZ. I mean, there's certainly some legitimate arguments against high taxes, but there's an entirely other way to approach this, which you were getting at, Christine, which is that conservatives generally believe in things like free markets because, in part, we believe that they will serve the poor best. They will serve minorities best. It is the best hope individuals trying to get ahead.
Yeah, it's likely a more libertarian argument, but the things that you outlined, Christine, like redlining, that's public policy.
Right.
And that is the heavy hand of government executing directives that the market wouldn't otherwise tolerate.
Right.
So, and that's part of why the one essay in the 1619 bit that was attempting to impugn the antebellum South as some sort of a capitalist utopia was so pernicious, because it went after some of these very foundational understandings of what capitalism means and conflating definitions. It's sort of to the extent that it was almost confusing profit with capitalism. Like, mm-hmm. If you make profit in any way, shape, or sense, then you're involved in capitalism, as though profits preceded the definitions of capitalism. Once we had a means of exchange, you had profits. We didn't. That was, you know, that predates Adam Smith by several centuries. But there was one, you know, which I thought was illustrative, and I sent it over a text message to everybody. I wanted to read this passage from this essay. When an accountant depreciates an asset to save on taxes, or when a mid-level manager spends an afternoon filing in rows and columns on an Excel spreadsheet, they are repeating business procedures whose roots twist back to slave labor camps.
I feel that way about Excel spreadsheets, I have to tell you.
I mean, they are quite
impressive. I think they're on to something here.
But, I mean, at base, and this is just one anecdote from this very long essay, some of which was interesting, a lot of it was like that, seemed to me a revisionist effort to impugn capitalist energy and enterprise as a racist enterprise by virtue of the accidents of its birth. That it was essentially forged. American capitalism didn't look like the industrializing South, which allocated resources based on the marketplace to industrialization, and looks more like the honor-bound culture of the South, which didn't do any of that stuff, and instead sort of languished in its the antebellum haze, you know, the honor culture, and didn't industrialize, and that is much more like American capitalism, and that just to me makes zero sense. And it's sort of ahistorical. I mean, there's plenty of scholars who've worked on that. The article quotes many scholars, but it avoids quoting anybody else who takes issue with the conclusions in the piece, and there are quite a few of them.
Yeah. Well, I think it also doesn't allow for a richer and deeper discussion of some of the cultural and family issues that have traditionally been the focus of conservatives when it comes to issues like the black family, the breakdown of the sort of neighborhood and social culture that offered, you know, support through churches and other organizations that supported neighborhoods, supported each other. That breakdown is happening in white America too. We're seeing a lot more of it now. But I think that there's this rich history that can be explored, not for guidance in some ways, right? But if you were coming at this from a conservative perspective, you're really told pretty forcefully time and time again that you're not really allowed to talk about black family structure. You're not allowed to talk about out-of-wedlock births. You can talk about that in the context of white families because it's happening there too, and those numbers are increasing. But to talk about the family is now considered oppressive. And I think, again, that's just a dead end for everyone. We should all be concerned about this, not just for the sake of lots of kids who are growing up without good role models, without, you know, sort of a stable environment to where they're receiving nurture and care and good education. These things should matter to everyone, but it has become so racially polarized that it's difficult to have those conversations anymore.
By the way, there's also a little trap there, because if you do talk about it as it affects white families, the response is, oh, so now you care because it affects
right,
white families.
Exactly.
Where were you, you know, on black suffering?
Well, I think there's actually a really valid point to that. When you think about, for example, how the opioid crisis is discussed versus the crack epidemic in the 1980s. So now there's much more sympathy in the modern approach to this epidemic. Maybe we've evolved as a society over the last 30 years, and I think that's quite plausibly true. But I don't think there's no basis for the argument that there was a racial element to the discussion around the crack epidemic and the violence that arose from it, because it was a primarily inner city phenomena. And now that this is much more broader based, we get to talk about it with much more sympathy. I think that's a valid critique.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I think as a general proposition, it can be used as a cheap
sure line. It doesn't facilitate right problem solving or mutual understanding.
The other danger with all of this is the reaction stuff, right? I mean, Andrew Sullivan has a great essay in New York Magazine from the other day where he talks about, you know, being conservative versus being a reactionary and what fuels the reactionary mindset. And I do think, and I've heard this from conservatives I know, from certainly we hear it from Donald Trump a fair amount, this idea that, I'm so sick of hearing about race. It's just like the reaction is just disgust. It's like, oh, I'm always being called racist because I'm white. That's not fair. End of discussion. And that is the danger with these kinds of projects whose starting points and whose basis for argument is, you know, all white people are racist. They just don't know it. So we have to educate them. That's not a good place to start if you actually want to heal these divides. And I fear that, you know, that's the point we've been at for a while now, but I'm seeing occasionally, you know, some thoughtful people have that reaction, certainly ones I know who are in academia, who are, you know, not allowed to talk or research certain scholarly topics for fear that they will be called racist for doing so. And that's not freedom. That's not liberty. That's not what we're supposed to be about when it comes to discussing these very difficult issues.
Yeah, anytime the mission is to educate, even in an op-ed form, you run the risk of being patronizing.
Yeah.
It's probably just by virtue of the task before you to educate, you feel yourself. And the explainer news culture has generally been a detriment to to discourse, which we've discussed in previous podcasts. But we look forward to reading the rest of the 1619 essays and probably not discussing them on the future podcast episodes. But at least we'll have a fuller understanding of what the arguments they are trying to make are. But we're going to call it here. For John Podhoretz, who is not here but surely wishes you well, Abe Greenwald, Christine Rosen, and myself, keep the candle burning.